Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by, and welcome to the Methylene Chloride Risk Evaluation and Risk Management Call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. After the speaker's presentation, there will be a question-and-answer session. To ask a question during the session, you will need to press star one on your telephone. If you require any further assistance, please press star zero. Please be advised that today's conference is being recorded. I would now like to hand the conference over to your speaker today, Ms. Neva Cranek. Thank you. Please go ahead, ma'am.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you for joining EPA's Office of Pollution Prevention and Toxics webinar on managing unreasonable risks for methylene chloride under the Toxic Substances Control Act. My name is Neva Cranek. I'm the Associate Chief of the Existing Chemicals Branch in the Chemical Control Division, and my role is to moderate today's presentation. We have approximately 80 people on the line. If you registered, the agency emailed all attendees the link to the presentation that will be used and the agenda. If you did not receive the email with the link to the presentation, please email me at kramick.neva@epa.gov. Again, my email address is kramick.niva@epa.gov. I'll be happy to resend the link. Please open the link to the presentation and follow along. Today's agenda will include presentations from several people from EPA. After the presentations, for those who signed up to make remarks, we will have a period of public comment. We are limiting the remarks to 5 minutes per person. The webinar operator will introduce the speakers during the public comment period. The agency will not be answering questions during the webinar. Please know there are a variety of other forums that will be described during the presentation if you have questions or if you have an interest in further dialogue on risk management. Our first speaker this morning is Yvette Collazo, the new director of the Office of Pollution Prevention and Toxics. Thank you, Yvette. Please start your remarks now.
Good morning. Thank you, Neva. And good morning, everyone. It's a pleasure to be here today. I'm opening today's webinar to emphasize how much we value your input. This is a key forum for the agency to obtain public comment on the implementation of TSCA and risk management of the methylene chloride. Before I turn it over to my colleagues, Ingrid and Joel, I want to share just a few thoughts. With the amendments to TSCA that were enacted in 2016, we've been building a new regulatory program from the ground up, as you all know. We've taken some big steps in that process over the past several months, issuing our first two risk evaluations. The first one methylene chloride, you will be hearing about momentarily, and the second risk evaluation, which is on the 1-bromopropane, which you will also hear about during an upcoming webinar on September 30th. In these two risk evaluations, we have identified unreasonable risks to workers, occupational non-users, as well as consumers. Now, we're taking the next step in the process by moving to risk management. When unreasonable risks are identified, as you all know, TSCA requires the agency to undertake a rulemaking process to address the unreasonable risks identified. We want you involved early in that process, and that's why we're here today. Throughout this process, we'll be seeking input from you on potential risk management approaches, their effectiveness, as well as any impact those approaches might have on all of our stakeholders. Your feedback is important as we develop regulations that are practical and protective, and today kicks off that process. Now is a critical juncture for you to be involved. And again, we need and appreciate your input, expertise, and feedback now early in the process, and we can't even emphasize that enough. This will help us shape the ways we're going to address the unreasonable risk we found. You'll hear from Ingrid and Joel more about how you can get in touch and get involved in the process. Thank you again for your interest in TSCA, and on behalf of the Office of Pollution Prevention and Toxics, we look forward to working with you. Thank you.
Thank you, Yvette, and thank you to everyone who joined the webinar today. My name is Ingrid Fustel. I work in the Existing Chemicals Branch of the Chemical Control Division in the Office of Pollution Prevention and Toxics. I'll begin the presentation with an overview of the methylene chloride risk evaluation. So if you have the slide deck open, on the second slide, we have an agenda. Today's presentation will include background on the risk evaluation. Then we'll review the findings of the methylene chloride risk evaluation. Next, we'll discuss the risk management requirements for TSCA, the types of information that are required for risk management, transparency during the process, and additional information such as schedule and links to resources. On slide three, as you know, EPA must evaluate the risks presented by a chemical under the conditions of use and determine if the chemical presents an unreasonable risk of injury to health or the environment under the conditions of use. The agency does not consider cost or other non-risk factors. We also include unreasonable risks to potentially exposed or susceptible subpopulations which are relevant. The whole process takes around 3 to 3.5 years. On slide four, we have an overview of the risk evaluation process. Methylene chloride entered the risk evaluation process as one of the first 10 chemicals under TSCA. The draft risk evaluation was published in October 2019. It underwent peer review, and the resulting final risk evaluation was published June 24, 2020. A determination of no unreasonable risk is a final agency action, and for those conditions of use with identified unreasonable risk, they will undergo a risk management action. TSCA requires a proposed rule 1 year after the risk evaluation and another year after that for final. Now on slide five, the final risk evaluation, as we said, was published on June 24th. EPA evaluated 53 conditions of use. The final risk evaluation incorporates feedback from public comments and the Scientific Advisory Committee on Chemicals. The risk evaluation and supplemental materials are available in the dockets indicated on this slide. Now on to slide six. Methylene chloride is a colorless liquid with a sweet smell. It's a volatile organic solvent, and it's produced domestically as well as imported. EPA identified conditions of use during all the life cycle stages, including manufacturing, import, processing, distribution, industrial, commercial, and consumer use, and disposal. Methylene chloride has a wide range of uses as a solvent, propellant, processing aid, or functional fluid in the manufacture of other chemicals. You might find it in consumer or commercial products such as sealants, automotive products, and paint and coating removers. The aggregate production volume for methylene chloride was around 264 million between 2012 and 2015. On slide seven, you can see a visual representation from the risk evaluation of the life cycle discussed on the previous slide. And if you take a close look, you can get an idea of the volume of methylene chloride for each of these life cycle stages in this diagram. So on slide eight, we have the determinations of no unreasonable risk. For six of the 53 conditions of use, EPA determined they do not present unreasonable risk to health or the environment. This includes manufacturing, processing as a reactant, recycling, distribution and commerce, and industrial and commercial use as a laboratory chemical and disposal. As we said earlier, the unreasonable risk determinations are a final agency action. On slide nine, we have the unreasonable risk determinations. For the remaining 47 conditions of use, EPA determined that methylene chloride presents an unreasonable risk of injury to health. This is based on risks of injury to workers and occupational non-users during occupational exposures and consumers and bystanders during consumer use. Those risks include acute effects to the central nervous system, chronic liver effects, and cancer effects. The primary route of exposure is inhalation, though consumers may experience acute risks from the dermal endpoint as well. Central nervous system effects are used because methylene chloride is highly volatile and relatively small increases in exposure can lead from central nervous system effects such as impaired vision to more severe effects, including death. On slide 10, we have lists of the unreasonable risks for processing, industrial, and commercial uses. This, you can see this includes import, processing, incorporation into a formula, and numerous industrial and commercial conditions of use. On slide 11, the list continues for industrial and commercial conditions of use which present an unreasonable risk. And on slide 12, we have the consumer conditions of use which present an unreasonable risk. On slide 13, now we'll go through the basis of the unreasonable risk determinations, starting with occupational exposures for workers and occupational non-users. An occupational non-user is someone whose work activities don't directly involve methylene chloride or formulations containing methylene chloride, but who may be exposed while methylene chloride is used by others in their workspace. For workers and occupational non-users, the determinations are based off three hazard endpoints, including central nervous effects from acute inhalation, liver effects from chronic inhalation exposure, and cancer effects, including liver and lung tumors from chronic inhalation exposures. In the risk evaluation, EPA assumes the use of personal protective equipment for workers. In the case of methylene chloride, the OSHA standard sets a permissible exposure limit of 25 parts per million and requires use of air-supplied respirators. That being said, many of the conditions of use presented an unreasonable risk even when respirators were considered. With the exception of use as a spot remover, EPA assumed the use of gloves in commercial and industrial settings and did not identify unreasonable risks from acute or chronic dermal exposures. Additionally, EPA does not assume that occupational non-users are wearing PPE because they do not handle the chemical. On slide 14, we have the basis of the unreasonable risk determination for consumers and bystanders. For consumers and bystanders, the unreasonable risk determinations are based off of central nervous system effects from acute inhalation and dermal exposure. We do not expect bystanders to handle methylene chloride, and so do not include dermal exposures. We also do not assume consumers and bystanders use personal protective equipment. Unreasonable risk determinations are based off high-end estimates, though in many cases, unreasonable risks were also present at the central tendency for consumers and bystanders. And now I'll turn it over to Joel Wolf, Chief of the Existing Chemicals Branch in the Chemical Control Division, to present on risk management under TSCA Section 6.
Thank you, Ingrid, and thank all of you for joining today's webinar. I'm going to talk about the risk management requirements under Section 6A, and as Yvette said in her opening remarks, we are now at the last stage envisioned by the statute for the existing chemical program and process for moving chemicals through evaluation and into management of identified unreasonable risks. So under the statute, and I'm on slide 15, as Ingrid has already said, we have 2 years from a final risk evaluation to have a final rulemaking, 1 year for a proposed rule and then another year for the final. There are obviously a number of things that we are required to consider, such as alternatives and options and selecting of the effects, a statement of effects that apply to the rules. We do consider stakeholder input to be critical to the process now, as it has been throughout the first 3 to 3.5 years for the risk evaluation process, both via public comment periods and in one-on-one meetings and events such as this. We do expect, as a result of this process of requiring chemicals to move through the existing chemical program on a regular basis, that regulatory actions will significantly increase as opposed to the pre-amended TSCA time. Moving on to slide 16. Slide 16 is Section 6A of TSCA, which lays out the regulatory options that are available to us, and we can use these individually or in combination. And an example of how we use them in combination was with the methylene chloride final rule for consumer paint and coating removal, because that involved downstream notification, record keeping, and a ban. So this again lays out the various requirements that we can use as we address identified unreasonable risks that can range from addressing it at the manufacturing stage, processing, distribution, restricting the weight concentration in a formulation, requiring labeling or via the label itself on a product, or via SDS sheets. And we can also require the manner and method of use in the industrial and commercial sectors. Moving on to slide 17. This goes into, again, 6A and the regulatory options. And where we can regulate specifically, again, which is the manner and method of commercial use, the one caveat is that the consumer use, if you'll, on the previous slide, they were not mentioned. And that is because, and it means that we cannot directly regulate how a consumer uses a product, which informs the kind of regulatory approach that we would take to address identified unreasonable risks for consumer uses. Moving on to slide 18, this lays out some of the examples of the regulatory approaches that we'll take for conditions of use. One way is through an existing chemical exposure limit, or an ECHL. Those of you who are familiar with PELS by OSHA, or even in our new chemical program, they do new chemical exposure limits. And this would be much the same way, and in some ways we see some industry facilities would prefer this approach because it allows them the flexibility to determine what kind of engineering controls or administration controls and PPE are appropriate for their facility. We also recognize that there will be those workplaces that just specifically want us to tell them, these are the ventilation that you should use, this is the type of machine that you may use, and the PPE. And so we do recognize, and that is again why we want to engage and are engaging already with a number of the stakeholders to find out the kind of workplaces, because we do recognize that there is a vast difference between an industrial workplace as opposed to an auto repair shop. And again, some of the examples we can require hazard communication and label directions. And then we can also limit how it is, what occurs for the disposal part of the process. Moving on to slide 19, one of the ways, and I know in talking with some of you already, you've heard me talk about the concentration and a limit on the concentration amount. And one of the ways that we would do that is if we see a product, a use that has numerous products, but we know that there is a range of concentration limits across the products that are available for that use. If there's a product, for example, that has a 30 weight fraction concentration in it, and there's some that have 70, but the 30, there is no unreasonable risk with the 30 weight concentration in the product, but we know that it is used for that same use as the 70. To us, that's an indication that it is efficacious at that lower amount, although we do recognize there are other components of a formulation that also may inform how its use. But again, that is something that we are actively looking at. There's another component, which obviously was not spelled out explicitly on the slide of 6A and our regulatory options, but some of you will remember that we did an advance notice of proposed rulemaking at the same time that the ban on consumer uses in paint and coating removal. And that advance notice of proposed rulemaking was a training, certification, and limited access program. And that is very much something that we are considering, because we do recognize there will be instances where we may ban the chemical for certain conditions of use, be it for consumers or perhaps some subset of the commercial sector, but that there are other parts in the industrial or other parts of commercial sectors that there is no unreasonable risk or the risk can be mitigated and the use should still continue. And so we would set up a program like that to limit the access to those that should not have access to the chemical while still allowing the use to continue in those areas where there is no unreasonable risk. And again, we can specifically require engineering controls, ventilation requirements, and then there is the record keeping and downstream notification, because it is important for us that the entire supply chain knows what the limitations may or may not be on a chemical and the product and uses that may occur for it. Moving on to slide 20, section 6C discussion. And while the regulatory requirements are under 6A, section 6C has requirements that we need to consider in the context of crafting our regulatory approaches. We need to describe the effects and magnitude of exposure to human health or the environment, the benefits of the chemical for various uses, and then reasonably ascertainable economic consequences of the rule. And we need to be aware of the effects on the national economy, small business, technological innovation, the environment, and public health. One change under amended TSCA is that we will have obviously a primary regulatory action, and we only need to have at least one alternative. Prior to amended TSCA, the breadth of alternatives was significantly larger. And I do want to say, although Ingrid indicated that there were 47 conditions of use for methylene chloride with unreasonable risk, that doesn't mean that there will be 47 individual regulatory actions, and I'm making this number up. It may be when the proposed rule goes out for methylene chloride that there are only, say, three regulatory actions, and each one of those may address 15 or 20 of the conditions of use. So, again, don't think that you will be seeing 47 individual actions for each condition of use. Then on to slide 21, and I know that this complex consumer and durable goods section is very important to many of you. We've heard from the auto industry and the Toy Association and others about articles and complex consumer goods and complex durable goods, and TSCA clearly told us to be very cognizant of this as we move forward into our regulatory actions as well as during the risk evaluation process. Moving on to slide 22, many of you, or probably most of you, are well aware of the rulemaking process that we undergo. And this slide lays out a number of the executive orders that we need to be cognizant of. And some of these, we are actively already in the stage for them. There is the consultation and coordination with Indian tribal governments and federalism, and we expect those to begin this fall. The small entities, the SBREFA panels, we expect an announcement imminently in the next day or two of convening those panels later this fall, and I do encourage anyone who is a small business to reach out to Ingrid and let her know of your interest in participating in that panel. Moving on to slide 23, the types of information that inform risk management. And I know that we've engaged with a number of you even during the risk evaluation on similar information and understanding, and we continue to engage with our stakeholders, be them the expected regulated entities, environmental groups, unions, and others. And we are and continue to look because we want, as Yvette said, our regulations to be practical and protective. And to do that, we want to ensure that we have the best information that we are using to craft our regulatory approach. And so we do want to know, and we recognize that certain industrial and commercial sectors are more sophisticated than others. And so we are trying to figure out the best approach for the various conditions of use that work best for each sector that is potentially regulated. And so information on the types of machines, the ventilation, what you may already be doing to protect workers, that information is important and continues to inform the approach we'll take. And obviously, we want this process to be as transparent as possible, much like the risk evaluation process, with the engagement that we do both formally and informally. I am now on slide 24. We have already been holding a number of one-on-one meetings with stakeholders, and we will continue to do that throughout the fall. Because of the time frame for these rulemakings with a year, the first few months of a final risk evaluation and in probably the 6 months of the time frame after a final risk evaluation is an intense period of crafting our approaches, because any of you who have gone through and understand the rulemaking process know that there's also a period of time where our interagency partners formally comment on our approach, and that is typically a 90-day period. Moving on to slide 25, it again just reiterates what I've already been saying, that we do want to engage. The process needs to be as transparent as possible. There is nothing worse for us than to, and obviously to you, to have us work feverishly on a regulation with no engagement, and then the doors open and there is a public comment period on a rulemaking and people are like, oh my God. If you just talked to us, you would have had a better sense of what it actually is already occurring in the workplace and approaches that would have been more practical. I'm now on slide 26, and again, and obviously you're sensing a theme by now of engagement with us, of one-on-one meetings, webinars like this. Obviously today is methylene chloride. One bromopropane will be at the end of the month and will be very similar to this one. And we expect to follow this same approach for each chemical as it completes risk evaluation for those that have unreasonable risk identified. And again, we are doing our consultations and are actively moving forward with those. And now I am on slide 27, which gives you links to obviously Ingrid's email and Doug Parsons. The current chemical risk management activities will give you a link also to all of the chemical leads for not just methylene chloride, but also 1-bromopropane and the other chemicals undergoing risk evaluation in the first 10 and the ones that are just now starting it. And with that, I will turn it back over to Neva.
Thank you, Joel, and also Ingrid and Yvette. We will now begin the public comment period. I'm turning control over to the operator, who will introduce the speaker and open their line. And then the operator will continue this until all speakers who've signed up have completed their remarks. And again, we're requesting that each speaker limit their remarks to 5 minutes. Thank you.
As a reminder, to make comments, please press star 1 on your telephone. We have our first comment from Kathleen Wolf. Your line is now open.
Good morning, everyone. I appreciate the opportunity to comment. My name is Katie Wolf, and I'm a consultant. I've worked on safer alternatives to halogenated solvents for more than 30 years. I've done field testing with alternatives to methylene chloride, with companies using the chemical in a range of different applications. This includes many of the applications deemed by EPA to pose an unreasonable risk in the risk assessment. I strongly urge EPA to ban methylene chloride in all these applications. A ban, in my view, is the best strategy for dealing with the chemical for four reasons. First, there are demonstrated viable, safe, and cost-effective alternatives in all the unreasonable risk applications. Second, EPA has many statutory deadlines under the amendments to TSCA. EPA doesn't have adequate resources to examine and develop a diverse set of different regulations for each of the applications that pose an unreasonable risk. A ban on methylene chloride applications would allow EPA to do a thorough job in regulating the uses instead of adopting a patchwork of regulations for different uses. Third, and related to the second reason, a ban is the most reasonable option for enforcement purposes. As EPA knows, many, if not all, of the regulations adopted by the agency under other statutes allow EPA to delegate authority for enforcement to the states. In the case of TSCA, in contrast, EPA must enforce regulations adopted under the statute on its own. EPA unequivocally does not have the resources to enforce a range of different regulations on the uses of methylene chloride and all the other chemicals that will have to be regulated. As a consequence, a much simpler approach would be to adopt a ban on all unreasonable risk applications. Such a ban would be much easier to enforce at a higher level through the producers instead of through thousands of users. Fourth, there is a historical precedent for banning high-risk halogenated solvents that demonstrates there would be a successful outcome for this strategy. California banned methylene chloride itself in numerous consumer product applications many years ago. Alternatives were found, and there have been no consequences. At the national level, carbon tetrachloride was banned many years ago in traditional solvent applications because of its high toxicity. 111 trichloroethane, or TCA, was also banned in the 1990s because it contributed to stratospheric ozone depletion. TCA was used extensively in numerous solvent applications, many more than methylene chloride is used. And at the time, industry claimed there were no viable alternatives to TCA in many uses. But the ban on TCA was nevertheless adopted under the Montreal Protocol, and alternatives were found and implemented in all of its applications. In summary, then, I urge EPA to adopt a ban on all methylene chloride applications tagged as posing an unreasonable risk. I thank you for your attention. That's all I have.
Next is Marian Hoff. Your line is now open.
Hello, this is Marian Hoff with PPG. Thank you for the opportunity to provide comments. I was wondering, as the presentation was proceeding along slides 18 and 19, about the OSHA methylene chloride standard. Many of the comments that were presented on those slides are already addressed in the standard. Not only is there a 25 part per million PEL, but actions are required to be taken under the standard at the action level, which is one half of the PEL. There are also requirements in the standard that clearly outline hazard communication, training, defined restricted areas. It even goes so far as to protect individuals that may come close to the restricted area. Evaluations of the workplace are required on a periodic basis. Access to medical records is also addressed when it comes to employees, since they are required to be in a medical surveillance program. So there are many, many aspects that are very clearly outlined in the OSHA standard that I would urge EPA to take a closer look at. And by applying these requirements, I think that would help address one of the concerns that was raised about the different levels of sophistication in the different industries. So once again, to clarify, this is for industry uses of methylene chloride. And if industries that are using methylene chloride would adopt the OSHA methylene chloride standard as it's written, I think it would go a long way to address a number of EPA's concerns. So thank you once again for the opportunity to comment.
Next, we have Wendy Hartley. Your line is now open.
Good morning. My name is Wendy Hartley, and my son Kevin passed away from methylene chloride exposure. Almost 4 years ago, the EPA found that the use of methylene chloride in paint and coating removal presents an unreasonable risk to injury to health and proposed banning the chemical for that use by consumers and workers. This administration refused to finalize that ban for workers. Over 3 years ago, my healthy, football-playing 21-year-old son went into cardiac arrest and passed away due to exposure to a methylene chloride paint stripper he was using on the job, a product that he had been trained to use. 3 months ago, the EPA again found that methylene chloride in paint and coating removal presents an unreasonable risk to workers. It's too late for my son, and that makes me unbearably sad and also angry. There is no excuse for this to happen to anyone else's son or family member. EPA has now found twice that methylene chloride in paint and coating removers presents an unreasonable risk to workers. It must now immediately ban this use so that no other mother or family has to go through what we did. Nothing short of a ban will be sufficient. After Kevin's death, I learned as much as I could about the chemical that killed him and about the chemical safety law that was meant to protect him. I decided that I was going to do anything that I could to make sure that no other mother would have to go through the pain that I had. If I could tell Kevin's story and save lives in his honor, then I would talk to whomever would listen. Today, I'm talking to you as you consider what actions to take to eliminate the high risk this chemical presents to workers like my son Kevin. I want to remind you that the decisions you make have real-life consequences and that people will lose their children or loved ones if you don't ban methylene chloride paint strippers for workers. Workers, like my son, are on the front line, and failing to protect them is failing to protect the very vulnerable group that TSCA requires you to protect. Yet EPA's risk evaluation allows workers to be exposed to this chemical at levels that are 100 times higher than that needed to protect the general population against cancer. This is not okay. And under many scenarios, EPA makes assumptions about the use of safety gear that are unreasonable and unsupported. Despite these flaws in its risk evaluation, methylene chloride is so toxic that EPA still found unreasonable risks to workers from paint stripping. So there's absolutely no excuse for the EPA to continue in delaying action. Today, while methylene chloride paint strippers are off consumer store shelves, workers across the country are not protected. Instead of finalizing the ban on commercial uses of these products in 2017 after finding unreasonable risk, the EPA put off any action and decided to re-review the evidence on workers and paint strippers as part of its broader evaluation. This appears to have been a delay tactic designed to avert finalizing the ban. Now, 3 years later, we're back to square one, and in the meantime, more lives have been lost. Today, I ask that you immediately ban commercial uses of methylene chloride in paint and coating removers and protect workers like my son Kevin. This is critical to stop the senseless deaths from this toxic chemical. Thank you for taking the time to listen to me today.
Again, if you have comments, please press star 1. Our next comment is from the line of Melanie Banish. Your line is now open.
Hi, thank you for the opportunity to provide a comment today. My comments will be relatively short. Thank you, EPA, for the presentation today. This was really helpful. I would start by echoing the comments of Wendy Hartley and other mothers like her who have had to lose their children to the use of this really dangerous chemical, and would really echo the calls for EPA to finalize a ban on not just consumer uses of methylene chloride in paint strippers, but also the commercial users, because so many people who have lost their lives to the use of methylene chloride are workers. And then I would also encourage EPA and would say that EPA has a legal obligation when doing this risk management to really ensure that workers are protected. And as EPA is writing the risk management rules to ensure that workers are protected, I'm a little concerned about the presumption about the use of PPE by workers. I appreciate that EPA is assuming that non-occupational users are not using PPE, but EPA should also acknowledge the reality that workers have unequal access to PPE. PPE is not always used correctly, and EPA has to take those risks into consideration when drafting the risk management rules. EPA should also, as they are thinking about background exposures, should think about the ways in which the cumulative ways in which workers and consumers are exposed to methylene chloride from the variety of different uses that EPA has acknowledged, but also the amount of methylene chloride that's present in the air, that's present in drinking water, that is present in other non-TSCA uses. And then I am also a little confused about EPA's statement about not being able to regulate consumer uses, and so would appreciate from the agency a little bit more information about what that means. And again, methylene chloride is one of the most toxic chemicals among the first 10 that EPA is regulating, and so I think strong action is merited. Alternatives are available. Retailers have already stepped in to take action and remove these products from their shelves. And so EPA should really do the right thing and follow through with the ban. Thank you.
Next is from Jonathan Kalmus-Katz. Your line is now open.
Thank you and good morning. I'm John Kalmus-Katz from Earth Justice. First, I want to thank EPA for convening this meeting and soliciting stakeholder input into the risk management process. Any discussion of risk management must begin with the changes that Congress made to EPA's risk management obligations in the 2016 TSCA amendments. Prior to 2016, EPA could only regulate chemicals using the least burdensome requirements. That constraint proved unworkable. It was used by industry to overturn EPA's asbestos ban in the early 1990s, despite indisputable evidence of asbestos's carcinogenicity, and it kept EPA from issuing any risk management rules for nearly three decades after that. The elimination of that requirement was one of the main objectives of the recent TSCA amendments. In those amendments, Congress replaced the least burdensome requirements mandate with a new requirement that EPA regulate chemical substances to the extent necessary so that the chemical substance no longer presents unreasonable risk. This is a sea change for risk management, shifting from a system focused on limiting regulatory costs to one focused on protecting public health. The law requires EPA to eliminate unreasonable risk. It cannot select a risk management option that leaves any potentially exposed or susceptible subpopulation in harm's way. At times, there may be more than one option that is capable of eliminating a chemical's unreasonable risks. When that occurs, there is no legal obligation for EPA to choose the least costly approach. Rather, Congress provided a range of factors that EPA must consider during the risk management process, including the effects of the chemical, the benefits of regulation, and the cost effectiveness of different regulatory options. Congress did not dictate how EPA is to weigh those considerations or select among alternatives. Moreover, EPA cannot consider regulatory costs under TSCA without also considering the benefits of the proposed regulation, which will often extend beyond those identified in the risk evaluation itself. TSCA gives EPA broad authority to select the strongest and most health protective regulation, as opposed to the least burdensome one. For methylene chloride, The need for such regulation is heightened by the immediacy and severity of the chemical's risks. Every year, more workers die from exposure to methylene chloride paint strippers, despite the availability of safer alternatives. EPA acknowledged the unreasonable risks posed by methylene chloride when it proposed a ban on commercial and consumer uses of methylene chloride paint strippers in January 2017. But the agency unlawfully excluded workers who faced the greatest risks from its final ban. Given EPA's confirmation of methylene chloride's imminent and unreasonable risks in the final risk evaluation, there's no excuse for further delay. EPA must immediately finalize its proposed ban on commercial uses of methylene chloride paint strippers. For other uses of methylene chloride, TSCA Section 63 permits EPA to make its risk management rules immediately effective upon their proposal in the Federal Register if a chemical is likely to result in unreasonable risk of serious or widespread injury to health before those rules can be finalized. Methylene chloride warrants such early action. While the proposed ban on methylene chloride paint strippers was pending before EPA, at least 4 people died from acute methylene chloride exposure, and countless others were exposed to serious long-term health effects. For a chemical that can kill in minutes, waiting up to 3.5 years for risk management rules to take effect is not a viable option. Instead, EPA should make any proposed regulations of methylene chloride immediately effective. Thank you for the opportunity to speak.
No more comments. Presenters, please continue.
All right, thank you. I would like to just make sure that there are no additional public commenters who wish to speak.
We have commenter Nicholas Chartres. Your line is now open.
Good morning. Can you hear me? Good morning. My name is Dr. Nicholas Charters, and I'm the Associate Director of Science and Policy at the Program on Reproductive Health in the Environment at the University of California, San Francisco. Today, my comments will focus on incorporating quantitative methods for estimating non-cancer risk, accounting appropriately for variability in the population at each level of exposure for cancer endpoints, and the findings of the first comprehensive review of methylene chloride fatalities in the US, which demonstrates banning methylene chloride is the most effective way to deal with the hazards it poses to workers. I have no conflicts to disclose. Exposures experienced by the full population at any level can result in an increased risk of adverse health effects. For all health effects for which there is some evidence of a relationship, suggestive, possible, likely, and known, the risk should be quantified. To not estimate risk would assume zero risk. Human health risk assessment and risk mitigation can be substantially improved by incorporating quantitative methods for estimating non-cancer risk. This would increase the scientific rigor of risk assessments, increase its utility for risk management, provide better information to the public for non-cancer risks, and allow fuller capture of benefits of environmental policy making. This would better align with the current approaches for estimating cancer risks, which are expressed as a probability, for example, 1 in a million risk, in contrast to non-cancer risks, which are based on a bright line that does not specify a particular risk level, for example, the reference dose, and assumes a threshold response. The reference dose and reference concentration does not estimate the probability or incidence of a response to any dose. It is also inconsistent with the numerous examples of dose-response relationships below the point of departure, where there is essentially no threshold for non-cancer effects across a diverse population. Furthermore, additivity to background in terms of both background health status and exposure to multiple chemicals supports an interference of no threshold for population risk of non-cancer effects and a transition away from a threshold assumption and towards a dose response method that quantify risk at doses within the experimental range as well as below it. For any and every condition of use that EPA has considered presents an unreasonable risk, it should quantify risk across multiple levels of exposure. This is important for risk mitigation to quantify the percentage of the population that will be harmed at all levels of exposure and exposure scenarios. Therefore, EPA should incorporate probabilistic approaches in quantifying risk instead of using an MOE for non-cancer endpoints in its benefits calculations for TOSCA chemicals that go to risk management under the unreasonable risk scenarios. Such methods have already been demonstrated by Hattis 2002 and Ginsberg 2012, along as many others. EPA should estimate exposure for non-cancer risks at different levels, such as 1 in 100,000, 1 in 10,000, 1 in 1,000, to give decision makers a level of risk at different exposure levels. This allows decision makers then the ability to clarify the health risks of exposures at different in different scenarios. Risk estimates should be calculated to include factors that account for life stage vulnerability, co-exposures to other pollutants, genetics, pre-existing conditions, and social factors, including poverty and racism and discrimination. For cancer endpoints, EPA must account appropriately for variability in the population at each level of exposure. The 2009 NAS report, Science and Decisions Advancing Risk Assessment, calculated that differences in median versus higher in response to carcinogens differ by a factor of 25. For all endpoints and conditions of use, EPA should provide information explicitly on who and who is not covered and protected, explicitly describe risks for each susceptible population, and risk managers should be explicit about what risks are acceptable and being allowed. Finally, UCSF is currently in the process of submitting the first comprehensive review of methylene chloride fatalities in the US. Through this process, we identified 85 unique fatalities since 1980, which is higher than has been reported to date. 87% of these fatalities were occupational, and the majority of these fatalities occurred when people were using paint strippers, cleaning solvents, and adhesives. We found persistent pattern of methylene chloride fatalities in the US, irrespective of current policies from CPSC, which instituted a warning label in the late 80s, or OSHA, which updated its standards for methylene chloride in the late 90s. According to the NIOSH hierarchy of controls, banning is the most effective way to deal with hazards, and in January 2017, EPA proposed to ban commercial uses for methylene chloride paint strippers. We recommend this policy approach as a reasonable way for EPA to prevent further methylene chloride fatalities. Thank you very much for your time.
Again, if you would like to have comments, please press star one.
Yes, and I think we had a few additional people who signed up online to make comments. And if you're having trouble getting through to the operator, again, this is neva.kramick, and you can email me, kramick.neva@epa.gov, or also please press star one and make sure the operator can hear clearly your name. Okay, I'm going to ask the operator, is there anyone in the queue to make public comments?
No further comments, ma'am.
Okay. I did receive an email from Robert Sussman, who may be trying to make a comment. Do you have a line that's identified as Robert Sussman?
No, ma'am, as of the moment.
Okay. And yes, as a reminder for those who have registered to make a comment, please do press star one. And May, I can provide you with the phone number that I think Robert Sussman is using on the separate line.
I already see his or saw his line here, ma'am. However, he needs to press star one again for me to be able to open his line.
Great, thank you. Can you let him broadcast to the group that message?
Okay, we now have the line of Mr. Robert Sussman. Your line is now open.
Okay. Thank you very much. I am speaking today on behalf of Safer Chemicals Healthy Families and the Environmental Protection Network. Both organizations have previously expressed to EPA their deep concern about the health effects of methylene chloride and the importance of protecting workers and consumers from unsafe exposure. We have been disappointed by EPA's rejection of our request for immediate measures to address the imminent and life-threatening acute effects of methylene chloride identified at EPA's risk evaluation. The latest evidence shows that since 1980, at least 85 people have died from CNS effects due to methylene chloride fumes. Others have experienced coma and incapacitation. We again call upon EPA to take prompt action to prevent additional deaths and serious harm without waiting for the completion of risk management rulemaking under Section 6. Turning to this rulemaking, EPA should be guided by the comprehensive framework for implementing Section 6A of TSCA that it set out in its January 19, 2017 proposed rule to ban paint remover uses of methylene chloride. As EPA explained, these rules must impose restrictions sufficient to eliminate the unreasonable risk identified in EPA's risk evaluation. Costs and other non-risk considerations play no role in selecting these restrictions. In addition, even among options that may eliminate the unreasonable risk, EPA must choose those restrictions that eliminate the risk reliably and effectively. Under the criteria in TSCA, we believe EPA must ban all consumer uses of methylene chloride. The risk evaluation shows that these uses present acute risks of death and incapacitation comparable in nature and magnitude to the paint remover risks on which EPA based its consumer use ban. Specifically, for all but one of the 15 products evaluated, projected acute exposures in one or more of EPA's use scenarios were above or alarmingly close to methylene chloride levels causing neurotoxic effects in human studies. We know from EPA's work on paint removers that label warnings are unlikely to protect consumer, and EPA assumes that consumers will not use personal protective equipment. In short, only a ban will effectively and reliably eliminate the unreasonable risk to consumers. Turning to non-consumer uses, EPA's proposed 2017 commercial paint remover ban found that label warnings and PPE would likewise not be reliable and effective in protecting workers. While EPA may have erroneously assumed that workers use PPE in its risk evaluation, it also estimated risk to workers without PPE use. We believe the non-PPE risk estimate should guide risk management given the recognition of EPA and many other authorities of the limits of PPE. Finally, now that EPA has again found that commercial uses of ethylene chloride paint removers present an unreasonable risk, it should immediately finalize the 2017 proposed ban on these uses and avoid another redundant and time-consuming rulemaking. Thank you.
There are a few others who signed up in advance to make a public comment, and this is now the time to deliver that comment. So please press star one. Even if you've already done so, the operator may need you to press star one again to be recognized. Are there any additional public comments in the queue?
No, ma'am.
Okay. Thank you for all the public comments then, and for your participation in today's presentation on risk evaluation and risk management for methylene chloride. The next webinar on risk management will be held on September 30th. It will feature the findings from the final risk evaluation for 1-bromopropane. The sign-up is currently open for that webinar on September 30th, including for making a public comment. EPA very much appreciates your participation in today's presentation, and the team here at the Office of Pollution Prevention and Toxics looks forward to a continued dialogue on risk management under TSCA for methylene chloride. Thank you again, and I will now turn it back to the operator to close out the call.
Ladies and gentlemen, this concludes today's conference call. Thank you all for participating. You may now disconnect. Presenters, please stay for the post-conference.